Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 15, delivered on March 23, 2010. The title of this lecture is Weighted Average Cost of Capital.
Today, optimal capital structure. When a company uses money, it faces a cost of that money. Now, a company has different sources of money. For example, your first company, your source of money might be your dad and mom. Well, that's just ridiculous. Your source of money might be this guy who hangs out in the alleys and offers attractive loan rates with aggressive collection methods. But taking aside those alternative financing vehicles, as we call them, the traditional ways that a company brings in capital are these. It can borrow money. It can sell stock, common stock. It can sell preferred stock. But here's something that is really, really cool. There's an old-fashioned way to bring money into the company for new projects. As the late, great John Houseman would say, you earn it. The first source of capital for a company should be, over the long haul, its net income. That should be the first place a company gets its money. Because that is what we call internally generated equity. Internally generated equity. You see, after I have paid a dividend out of my earnings, the money that is available really still belongs to the shareholders. It really does. That money is the shareholders' money. You are just using it to enhance shareholder value in the future. And so that's why we call it internally generated equity. Equity is the owner's part. And we are generating that, and after we paid the dividend, shared some of it with the shareholders, the remainder of that still belongs to the shareholders, and we can use that to generate income for the next period. Build inventory, build buildings, build this, build that. So the first place you look for capital, really in a company, is from your bottom line. Not from the banks, not from the capital markets, the stock brokers, from your own net income. That thought is lost sometimes in the hustle and flow. We've got all these projects, we've got to get money in, we've got to borrow money, we've got to do a public offering of common stock. Try earning some. And then once you have shown that you are worthy, that with the shareholders' money, you can actually generate shareholder value, then it might be appropriate to go out there into the capital markets and request more to augment that. So here we go. The different components, the different places you can bring in money to the company are through debt, preferred stock and common stock, new common stock, and through internally generated equity, which is the same thing as saying earnings net of dividends. So these last two are externally generated equity. Actually, the preferred is an equity too. But the last two especially are of the first one, new common stock is externally generated equity capital. And then the last one is internally generated equity capital. These are the sources of capital available to the company. Now, you may remember from the first day of class, I told you something that was kind of an important idea. Nothing is free. Nothing in this life is free. There's going to be an opportunity cost to anything that you do. And if you go out to the capital markets and go to a bank and say, I should like $100,000, the bank might say, sure. But are they going to give you that money free? Oh, hell no. They're going to charge you interest. Now, there's a couple of things interesting about debt. First of all, debt is the safest of all the sources of capital. Because you know what happens if you don't pay back the debt? The bank seizes your assets. Yes, ETS. The bank seizes your assets. So debt is actually going to be generally the safest, which means that it will have the lowest cost because the debt holders have recourse against you. If you are a shareholder and you take what is technically known as an ass bath with your stock, you know who you can cry to? Your mommy. No one else. But if you are a debt holder and you don't get your money back, you will just go to a court and you will close that company down. So there is a lower risk profile with debt, and therefore there is a lower expected return with it. So debt capital will, by and large, be the cheapest form of the cheapest source of capital. That changes. As you acquire more debt, you will probably end up having to pay a higher marginal cost of capital. Because as you acquire more debt, you create greater risk of default on the debt. And we'll get to that later. But for right now, that is one reason that debt is cheap for a company. Debt is attractive for a company. But there's another thing about debt that is kind of unusual. Suppose that we have an EBIT for a company. An EBIT for a company. Let's say that this company has $500,000 of debt with an average cost of, let's say, 10% per annum. So that means that, let's look at two scenarios. Scenario one, this company has both of these scenarios have the company with an EBIT of, let's say $200,000. Now, in scenario one, the company does not have this $500,000 in debt. And therefore, in scenario one, it pays no interest. In scenario two, it will pay a $50,000 interest payment off EBIT. So that our earnings before taxes in scenario one would be $200,000. And our earnings before taxes in scenario two would be $150,000. Now, let's say that the tax rate on this company is 30% average. So the tax in scenario one would be $200,000 times 30%, or, for God's sake, help me out. $60,000, thank you. The tax in the second scenario is $45,000. So the net income in scenario one is $200,000 minus $60,000, or $140,000. The net income in scenario two is $150,000 minus $45,000, or $105,000. Now, wait a minute. Look at the numbers carefully. What's the difference in net income between the two scenarios? $35,000. But what was the interest payment they made? It was $50,000. Wait, what? Oh my, this company actually had a tax shield arise from the interest. The full $50,000 interest did not hit the company. In fact, the cost, that interest payment there, really, it wasn't $50,000, it was $35,000. The cost of debt after taxes, which is all that matters, K after taxes sub D, is going to be the cost of debt before taxes times 1 minus the tax rate. So if I give you a cost of debt, you go right after it and multiply it by 1 minus the tax rate, because that will tell you what the real after-tax, what the after-tax cost of debt was. Doing it in this scenario, the cost of debt before taxes was 10%. If I take 1 minus the company's tax rate of 0.30, I get 7%. Well, now let me take the 7% and times that by $500,000. Well, sure enough, there's the $35,000 after-tax interest. So when you do this, practically speaking, for me, on a work problem, a quiz, or an exam, right away, change that to after-tax cost of debt. Notice what this does. This makes debt, which was already a cheap, less expensive, I should say, source of capital, an even cheaper source of capital. And as the tax rate rises on a corporation, it becomes more attractive, debt becomes even cheaper. So we would see that there would be a favorability to debt in the capital structure of the corporation as the corporation becomes larger. Isn't that interesting? And interestingly enough, the problem is magnified because the corporate tax structure is progressive. So as the net income rises, the marginal tax rate gets even higher, which makes the tax shield even stronger, which makes the cost of debt even cheaper. So that progressive tax structure actually encourages debt by corporations as they grow and become bigger and bigger. So that has an adverse policy impact because you get this idea, too big to fail. Well, we've created a tax system that encourages one of the primary sources of failure for big corporations, the shield on their debt. Makes them take on more debt rationally, which in the end can burn their asses if they can't pay the bill to the bondholders. And by the way, this effect is also in consumer finance too. The tax shield, there's a similar tax shield that arises on mortgage interest. Okay? You get to deduct mortgage interest. So that makes taking on a mortgage to buy a house attractive. But if you are a low-income person, that tax shield is worthless to you because you have such a low tax rate to begin with. It's only as you go into progressively higher marginal tax brackets as an individual or a couple that that tax shield arising from the mortgage interest deduction becomes strong. So our tax policy encourages home ownership among the wealthier in preference over home ownership by the poor and the working class. Now, that's not some leftist, communist, Marxist propaganda. That's just the reality of it. Our tax system embeds a principle to reward the rich with houses and take away the incentive from the poor who might like to have a home of their own. And it also encourages overconsumption of housing across the board, but it definitely encourages overconsumption of housing among the wealthy. They can make a gigantic house they'll never use, but the mortgage interest is deductible, so they're going to buy it for the shield that it provides. Enough of that. That's one of those things that just bunches my boxers. Anyway, that's the cost of debt. Let me go on here with the cost of other parts of the story. What's the cost of preferred stock? Well, remember, the preferred stock works like this. There's a par value stated on the preferred stock certificate, or the virtual certificate, as it is these days. There's a par value. Let's say $100. And then there is a dividend declaration that is stated as a percentage of that par value. This preferred stock has a dividend of 3%. 3% of what? 3% of that stated par value on the preferred certificate. So if the preferred par value were $100 and the stated dividend is 3%, then, essentially, what you got there is a stock that will pay a dividend forever and ever and ever of $3 a year. That's a level perpetuity, a zero growth level perpetuity. So we can start our process of talking about the cost of capital when it's preferred capital by noting that the formula you would use to calculate the present value of the stock would be the price right now would be the flat dividend over the discount rate that you would use. And I showed you an example of that last week. So, yeah. Well, that's nice. What does that have to do with the cost of capital? Well, it has this. I can rearrange the formula to find the cost of capital. The cost of capital would be the dividend over the price of the stock. That's how I could get the cost of capital if it's preferred capital. If it's preferred capital, it's... But it would have to be existing preferred for this trick to work. Okay? So I have to think about it this way. What if we didn't have any preferred stock in the company? But we're talking about raising capital for our projects. And we've talked about, well, the bank will lend us this, this, and this. And if we borrow more than that, they'll charge us this much more and all that, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and someone brought it up, well, how about if we sell some preferred stock? Okay, well, we can call up our underwriting, the guys who did our first underwriting, and say, well, how much, what would we need to do to raise preferred stock capital? Well, they say, well, we'll sell it for you. We'll just set up the underwriting. We'll do it on a firm basis, and we'll charge you a price, a flotation cost. Now, they'll probably state the flotation cost in some way as a percent of the price that they'll charge. Well, we're going to send this stock out the door at $95 per share preferred, and we're going to charge you 5% on every share we sell. Oh, okay, so that's a flotation cost of $4.75, yes? Yes. Okay. So if I were to look at the cost of raising new preferred stock, I would start by saying that the company will get the price minus the float. Okay? Now, I'm not going to go through the algebra of this, but I'm going to say that the cost of preferred, when all is said and done, what you will use for your calculation, if I'm raising capital through preferred stock, would be the dividend, which would be the same dividend forever, which would be a percent of the par, divided by the price minus the float. That's what you will, the formula you will use to calculate the cost of capital through raised from new issue preferred. So that's the second source of capital cost. The cost of new issue preferred is going to be the constant dividend that would be paid forever on the preferred divided by its price less its float. Okay, you with me on that? Just use that formula. Don't argue about it, just use it for God's sake. Okay, now, the cost of new common. There are two ways to attack the cost of new common. We can actually do it in the same way that we did this one, except with a, if it's got a constant growth dividend, we can play with that formula. Remember the cost, the price would be the dividend at period one divided by K minus G. So I can rearrange that to say that K would be D1 over P. With new preferred, with new common, with new issue common, it would be D1 over P minus F, because you'd have to do that same cost of the float that you'd pay to the brokers. Oops, K. Plus G. Forgot to put my plus G on there. That would be the cost of new preferred. Of new common. God. So, the cost of new common is going to be the dividend at period one divided by the price of the stock now minus the float. And the float is going to be a number, okay, an amount. I might say, well, they're selling the stock at $20 a share. The float is 4%. So you would put 20 minus 4% of 20. What the hell is 4% of 20? 80 cents? 20 minus 80 cents. So you would write down here in the denominator 20 minus 80 cents. And then you have to add the growth rate back onto it. Now, if it's internally generated capital, then there's no float. For existing common stock, then, it's just D1 over P0 plus G. So here, taking all of the yammering that I've done aside, here are the four cost formula for capital. Those are the four. Yes?
For the preferred and common stock, are those dividends at the percent stated or the
No, amount? Numbers. All numbers. And the G, that would be a decimal. That would be a decimal. Those are the cost of capital formulas for the different components of capital. Now, when the company goes out, it's going to find projects that it might want to do. It's going to start looking for money to do these projects. It's going to look at how much it has generated at the net income line in earnings. Then it's going to look to the banks. Then it's going to look to the possibility of a sale of common or preferred or both. Typically, you won't see companies reaching to the preferred. Preferred stock and I'm speaking a little out of turn here, is not a good idea. You see, it's like a marriage. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean it exactly like that. You see, with stock, whenever you sell stock, you're married to the shareholder forever unless that shareholder goes and sells your stock. With debt, it's like going to a country and western bar, and you go home at 2 with a 10, and you wake up at 10 with a 2. And then you can say, please leave, for God's sake. Let me kill myself. You see, with debt, you can pay the son of a bitch off. And then you don't ever have to see it again. Oh, jeez. With stock, you have to make a breakfast for the rest of your sorry life. You think you're going to heaven? There's that stock there with you. So it turns out it was hell. You see, you're married to it forever with stock. So there, right there, makes you think, do I really want to issue stock? Because these are going to be with me forever. This stock is going to be there forever unless I can generate enough money to buy it back into the treasury. With preferred stock, it has even another bad aspect. Preferred stock is common stock with children because you are going to have to pay a dividend forever and ever and ever, or at least until the kids get married and move out. You see, with the preferred stock, that dividend, you have to pay it. You don't pay it, you can't even pay the common stock. You have to pay the preferred dividend, so you are really locked in with preferred. It takes precedence. Its dividends will take precedence over common. The preferred shareholders sit in this hazy land between debt and equity. So here's the bottom line of it. You would probably, first and foremost, avoid preferred stock. You would first and foremost like to go for debt. Why debt? Because debt is so darned cheap. You know what? Even equity, internally generated equity, is more expensive than debt. Because you see, if you have internally generated equity, that you could do a lot of things with that that could earn money. That means the opportunity cost of that internally generated equity is actually fairly high. Debt is cheaper. And you will see this when I do the problems, when we work out problems, you'll see that the debt is almost jaw-droppingly cheaper. So what does that mean in the final analysis? Why wouldn't every company just be 100% debt? This was what two financial analysts, financial scholars, Modigliani and Miller, asked. And there's this thing, well, they were just stupid what they came up with. What they came up with was that the optimal capital structure of a corporation is 100% debt. Because debt's cheaper than any other source of capital, every company should be 100% debt. And there was this kind of like this derision, well, obviously they don't know what the real world's about because we don't see that. No, we don't. The point they were making is, why don't we see that if debt is cheaper than equity? Here's why. In the real world, as I said before, the more debt you take on, the riskier your company gets. And the riskier your company gets, the bitchier the debt holders are going to be. As your debt goes up, your margin between EBIT and what you have to pay in interest gets narrower. Your risk of default goes up, therefore the cost of debt goes up. So here is what the bottom line is. If I am to assign a weight to the existing structure of a corporation, I would write the weight that debt has in the capital structure as W sub D. The weight that preferred has in the existing capital structure is W sub P, and the weight of internally generated equity is W sub S. And you say, well, why aren't you putting in the W sub N? We're talking about what is there now, not what would be there if we raise new capital. What is the weight now? So when a company is deciding what the weights are, how much debt, how much preferred, how much is internally generated equity in the company, existing common stock, we would look at it like this. We'll look at one of them. The debt to total assets of the company. And here would be the 100% mark. The Modigliani-Miller world, where debt is always cheaper, would be this. As you put more of the debt as a percentage, your cost of capital goes down to KDAT. It will just keep going down. If you're 100% debt, your cost of capital, your weighted average cost of capital, WACC, which would be the weight of debt times the cost after tax of debt, plus the weight of preferred times the cost of preferred, plus the weight of stock times the cost of existing common. The weighted average cost of capital would just decline as you put more weight into the debt. Until you are 100% debt, your weighted average cost of capital is at its minimum, the cost of debt after tax. That would be the Modigliani-Miller world. But the reason that doesn't exist in the real world, why companies don't plow to 100% debt as their capital structure, is because in the real world, as you take on more debt at first, yeah, debt is adding cheap stuff to the capital structure. But at some point, you have too much debt, debt begins to get expensive. And the weighted average cost of capital curve, the WACC curve, begins to go up. The point of this lecture is that companies are excitedly interested in the minimum point of the weighted average cost of capital curve. It is shaped like a U, and companies spend a great deal of time concerning themselves about, first of all, finding the optimal capital structure, where the weighted average cost of capital is its minimum, and then staying there. In fact, in some cases, companies will just issue stock or borrow money just to get their debt to total assets ratio back into line with the, what they think is the weighted average cost of capital, optimal. So that's where we start, but the next step will be Thursday when we do the marginal cost of capital. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.